Welcome, everybody, to Between the Lines, the podcast from Jewish Quest. My name is Simon Eder, and each week I'm joined by a special guest who helps us deconstruct that week's parasha, exploring new insights and meaning in the Torah. And it is wonderful to be joined today by Jeremy Tabak, who's the content manager and faculty at Hadar, where he teaches, curates, and edits Hadar's content, both online and in print, and also for Project Zug courses. Jeremy is also pursuing a PhD in Talmud at JTS, and he'll also be in the UK in Edinburgh this summer teaching at Azara. Jeremy graduated from the University of Manchester with a master's in physics, and is also an alumnus of Yeshivat Hadar and also the conservative yeshiva in Jerusalem. And it is wonderful, Jeremy, to welcome you back to Between the Lines to discuss the final two parashiot of Vayikra. I can't believe that we have got to the end of Vayikra, which will, of course, round off with Baha and Bahukotai, and a huge welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. We're really leaving Vayikra on a bang.
Look forward to that. Look forward to what we have in store today. And maybe to launch, maybe you might share your kind of understanding of the meaning and purpose of the Shemitah and the Yovel year.
Parshat Bahar Bechukotai lays out just like a comprehensive vision of social equality from the Torah, where every 7 years the land has to lie fallow and the land becomes ownerless, meaning that anybody can eat the food from any farm and any place anywhere, and you cannot store the food from that year to make a profit off it. That's one major piece. And then every seven cycles of seven-year Shemitah cycles, then there is an additional year, the Yovel year, where all the slaves go free, meaning that the slaves they're imagining are basically debt slavery, that you needed extra money, so you sold yourself to another citizen as a slave for a time. And no matter when that sale took place, in the Yovel, in the Jubilee year, you go free. And you return to your ancestral holding, and everybody returns to their ancestral land. So the sale of the land in Israel is never permanent, because the land was originally apportioned to the 12 tribes and to the clans within each tribe. And in every Yovel year, you go back to your tribe's land. It's a way of, there might have been inequality arose in the 50 years over that period of time, and all of it goes back to the way it was before, the way it was supposed to be, the way God intended it to be in the Yovel.
Thank you for that important introduction. And I guess just really honing in on the Shemitah really being an important example of how so much of the Torah really has the land in mind. And drawing on that, I wonder really how you might answer whether the Shemitah then is still relevant.
Yeah, Simon, can I just a question about that, which is, do you mean the land as in the earth or land as in the land of Israel specifically?
I guess maybe that is an important distinction, and keen to understand how you understand land.
Okay, fair enough.
And maybe what sources you draw on in order to arrive at your conclusions too.
So I think that the focus on land and agriculture in the Torah obviously has its roots in whatever the ancient Near Eastern agricultural background. And it's hard for us to relate to, for many of us in the modern world, who are disconnected from our food production, our food sources. And I think a lot of the emphasis of the Torah on the physical land is, and can be, should be, a call for us to be more connected to our land and our food sources and think about that in a more different way. It's, I think if you try to explain to someone in ancient Israel about like how we get our bread from a shop, they were like, wouldn't understand anything that we're saying. It's wrapped in this plastic and it's cut up in slices. It just doesn't make any sense. And also it's the easiest it's ever been to just get a loaf of bread. It requires almost no effort from most of us. So yeah, so the emphasis on land is an important, I think, correction to modern life, which often disconnects us from that land and from the people who work that land, because it's very easy to forget when you go to a supermarket and everything is right there. It's very easy to forget that there were real people who worked very hard to bring you this product, and those people need to be looked after as well. So there's that aspect of land in general, but there's also the aspect of the land of Israel itself, it seems pretty clear that the Shemitah and the Yovel only applies in the land of Israel, because the reasoning in the Torah for these agricultural, specifically laws, is that the land belongs to God. And the land which belongs to God is the land of Israel. That is specifically God's land. Sure, the whole world is God's, that's true, but the land of Israel is specifically God's land. And therefore, God can decide what to do with it. God decided to apportion out the land to the 12 tribes and the clans and the families within those tribes. And God therefore decides every 50 years it should go back to the way it was, because that was the way it was supposed to be the whole time. God also, it's all rooted in God's ownership as well. Even the slaves going free is exactly the same. It says, ki avadaihe, that the children of Israel, they're not slaves for each other. They shouldn't be slaves of other people. They're actually my slaves, avadai, my meaning God's slaves. And therefore they can't work forever as a slave for someone else. They have to go free after 50 years. Because not only does God own the land that's there, but God also owns the people of Israel. In a more diaspora setting, it's easier to hone in on the idea that sort of we serve God as servants, or even slaves, I think is not a too strong a term, in a way that can be separated from the land belonging to God piece. On the other hand, we also live in an age of national sovereignty in Israel. And one of the greatest Jewish heretics, Spinoza, his basic argument about the Torah, by the way, I'm not a Spinoza expert anyway, but I once read this thing. I was TAing a class at JTS. And anyway, his main argument is that the Torah was a constitution for the people of Israel who living in their lands. As long as they had sovereignty, then the Torah, specifically things like Shemitah and Yovel, applied to that polity and that nation. And as soon as that sovereignty ended, which it did with the destruction of the Second Temple, in theory, and it's a pretty clear reading of the Torah, that actually just is over. There's no reason to follow those laws anymore. And indeed, like for 2,000 years, the laws of Shemitah and Yovel were not particularly followed once the Jews lost national sovereignty. The extent to which they were actually followed before they lost national sovereignty is also not totally obvious. The evidence is a bit conflicting about many of these things, but nonetheless. But that's it. Now that we're back in a situation where Jews do have a sovereign land in the same location as where it used to be, it opens up. Actually, I think it's very relevant today, because if you're reading the Torah, that land still belongs to God. There's no reason otherwise. And God allows us to live there as long as we follow God's laws. And that is where B'chukotai goes, is that if you refuse to look after this land by giving it its required Shemitah years and its Yovel years, when it can rest from all the agricultural work that you have to do. If you don't do that, then God says, then God will drive you out of the land, and the land will lay desolate and will have its Shemitah years without you. It doesn't need you to have the Shemitah years. It will rest either way. Either it will rest because you follow the law and it will rest every 7 years, or it will rest because there are no inhabitants anymore, because God has driven them out. And that's fundamentally all together in that concept of the fact that God owns the land. God can choose who lives there, and God can decide what happens to that land. And we're just tenants, essentially, in the land of Israel. But nonetheless, that sovereignty, I think, matters, kicks in. The Shemitah is kept in, many aspects of Shemitah are kept in modern Israel today. And you got this year, the etrogs we had on Sukkot that came from Israel, you had to leave them to decay by themselves, because they were actually etrogim from the Shemitah year. So you couldn't use them for compost or anything. You couldn't benefit financially from their existence. So my etrog is still shriveling away on my counter 6 months ago.
One image to share. Thank you. There's so much wonderful elements to draw from in the discussion of the Yovel and the Shemitah. And yet, at the same time, a careful reading perhaps reveals something of a less comfortable reality. Not everyone discussed in these laws is free. It would seem that the Torah's audience is free people, but people who own other people, like who are enslaved, that sort of point one. And then perhaps in the discussion of the Yovel, the Torah insists that any Israelite who sells themselves into enslavement must be freed in the Jubilee year on the one hand, but the ruling doesn't include enslaved non-Israelites. And I wonder, when encountering this kind of ethical tension in the Torah, how we might respond.
Yeah, for sure. So the fact that the Torah basically condones or allows slavery is a serious problem. I have a few different thoughts about that. The first one is obviously that, and this is very Rav Yitz Greenberg of me, is more like the Torah had a certain setting in mind and couldn't imagine, its audience couldn't imagine certain things. They lived in a world where slaves existed, and they couldn't imagine a world without slaves. And it's a slow process. Like, sure, eventually the idea is to get rid of all the slaves, but that's not necessarily where you can start. If you started there, people wouldn't necessarily have listened and paid attention to the other stuff that was important. But it's like the very gradual covenant is very much core to Rabbi Greenberg's thoughts. Thinking about him because I've been working on his book being published from Hadar shortly.
A shameless plug is most welcome.
Great. Too late. That's one aspect. The other aspect is, I think there's like a few uncomfortable realities that we need to see ourselves in when it comes to slavery in the Torah, which is that we want to imagine that slavery is gone. It isn't. That's not the case. We don't imagine. We could imagine a world without slaves. We actually do live in a world with slaves. It's just that they're mostly further away from us. Or people who live in conditions that are essentially slaves, even if they're not technically slaves. It's just a very real inequalities in the world. So what the Torah has to speak to the circumstances we live in, and our circumstances are not as different as we want them to be. And I would say the notion of owning other people can be uncomfortable, but it also is true in a very real way. And this is countercultural of me in the modern world. But as someone who did Kiddushin for his wedding, we actually did double Kiddushin, where I did Kiddushin where I took possession of my wife, and my wife did Kiddushin where she took possession of me. But what that clearly entails is that we think that possession of people or aspects of people is not inherently problematic. And it really comes up with my kids. Like, I do own them to a certain extent. Obviously, they have their own mind and their own autonomy to a certain extent, but not that much, especially the younger they are. My oldest kid is 5. So I don't know. I don't think that the very notion of owning people should be beyond the pale. And like I said, the key thing that slavery they're talking about in the Torah is, in this parsha, is the idea of debt slavery, where you basically run out of money, you can't operate your household anymore, and your only option left is to sell yourself to one of your kinsmen. And part of that is, and that leads to the Jewish slave question, which is that this whole law applies to citizens. And what they're assuming is that the only citizens in the nation are Israelites, essentially, that they're like synonyms to be an Israelite or to be a citizen of that nation. It's going to be the same in that context. So that is that. And there's the other part, which is what I said before about, right, God owns us. God doesn't actually necessarily own other people who haven't signed up for the Jewish mission, the Jewish covenant. I think that's the perspective that the Torah comes to here. And therefore, it makes sense for this law to apply. I don't know, it doesn't excuse the racist application of the law, but it does explain it to a certain extent, which is that it makes sense in the context where God owns us and we are God's slaves, for God to be able to say, actually, therefore, you have a maximum time limit, versus for other people who God doesn't own, quote unquote, or even not quote unquote, for that law not to apply to those people. I would also say that the ethnic nature of slaves going free in the Torah may be a disagreement between different books. That the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy, they talk about the Eved Ivri. And most of the time, Ivri is understood to be ethnic designation, which is Hebrew. But actually, our parsha never mentions Hebrew. It mentions B'nai Yisrael. It never mentions this term Ivri. Dvarim and Shmot, the Eved Ivri goes free, works for 6 years, and the seventh year goes free. I actually think there's a pretty strong argument to be made that actually the word Ivri in those cases doesn't mean Hebrew in the ethnic way. It means that from the root avar, to pass. In other words, it's a passing slave, a temporary slave. In which case, the laws in Shmos and Tevarim would be ethnically neutral. Any slave that you have works for 6 years and then goes free afterwards. Again, this is talking about the kind of debt slavery thing that we're talking about. Whereas Vayikra introduces this notion that Jewish slaves go free in the 50th year. It doesn't have this idea, by the way. It never mentions the idea in Vayikra that the slave goes free in its 7th year of service. So Vayikra seems to have a completely different notion, which is that every 50 years, Jewish slaves go free, Israelite slaves go free. So it's possible that the ethnic application of slaves going free is actually like already in dialogue, in debate within the Torah itself. If Eved Ivri is not ethnic, which I think there's a pretty strong argument for. In which case, there are two competing paradigms. There's the kind of the temporary slave you get for 6 years then leaves. And then Vayikra comes in and says, no, there's a 50-year time limit. Those ideas then get combined over the, once the Torah is canonized and people receive the Torah as a whole book, those two laws get combined. In the rabbinic law, if you became a slave sort of 3 years before the Yovel, you do the 3 years and then you go free in the Yovel. But yeah, so those are some answers to that question, but it's uncomfortable also.
We will live with the health as you were discussing slavery. I couldn't help but jump to think about how we're all about to become enslaved to AI, and I wonder what the Yovel has in mind with that.
Our new machine overlords, for sure. Also, didn't you all just sign up to serve King Charles?
And he signed up, I think, to serve us as well. Okay,
that's the same deal with God and us. Like we sign up to serve God, and God signs up to protect us. You know, we get both.
Sounds good. Maybe rattling on to the curses that we encounter both here and at the end of Deuteronomy. I really wonder what is the similarities and differences as we encounter them in Vayikra and Devarim.
Well, these curses of what happens if you don't do what you're supposed to do and then you get brutally kicked out of your land. So this is obviously one of those things that plays into the classic Christian anti-Semitic stereotype that the God of Judaism is vengeful and violent, which is not totally untrue, but also the God of Judaism is loving and kind. But yes, it's obviously a real problem in that way. And there's also a part of me part of it plays into this idea, and this is very important for Vayikra, a little bit less so than for Devarim, which is that we are supposed to be God's slaves working God's land. And if we don't fulfill our terms of the bargain, God can get rid of us. And that's actually completely within the rights of God according to our arrangement. And part of that brutality is it's like love soured. It's like the love that God has for us, that's how much God will take vengeance for us when that love is betrayed, which is a very real human thing. But it's not necessarily what we want to ascribe to God. And I think there's a sense in which it's like really describes the reality of Jewish life over many centuries and many millennia, which is that, yeah, God has actually destroyed us multiple times. And there's very few of us left, or there have never been so many of us. And I think one of the things that strikes me about this idea of if we keep God's promise, will God keep God's promise to us, is that one of the things that God promises to Abraham in the Torah is that we should be as numerous as the stars and as numerous as the sun. You can't count the grains of sand on the beach and we'll be as numerous as the grains of sand. And I think it's just very hard to say that's true in the world where there are 7 billion people and 14 million of them are Jews. I think that's the last count that I've got. That is a tiny percentage. Very hard to say that fulfills the promise of becoming like stars in the sky or sands on the beach. Yeah, so I don't know. On one hand, it makes you uncomfortable. On the other hand, it does describe the reality that the Jews have experienced and the people have experienced, which is, yeah, brutality and violence. And yeah, reduced numbers and exile from our land. And I don't know. I don't have anything redemptive to say about it, really.
Maybe let's end, hopefully, on a redemptive note. And that is that all of this is really bound up in a notion of covenant. And I wonder if you might maybe comment to end on why you see us, despite what you've said previously, why it is that we still cling to this notion of covenant.
So as we said, like the whole complex of this Shemitah and Yovel relies on the notion that we're in some kind of long-term agreement with God. And I've also said that, I don't know, it's not so obvious that God has kept up God's side of the argument, God's side of the agreement. And I think that also is illustrated in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple. A lot of Jews abandoned Judaism because they figured, I don't know, our temple was destroyed. The Romans are obviously superior. So what's so good about Judaism? Why should we hang on? And obviously we, the Jews today, are the descendants spiritually or literally of those people who decided to cling to Judaism anyway, regardless of the evidence. And there's something like amazing about this. So look at the world, see that there's basically no reason to think that our covenant is still operative for all the reasons I've said. The national sovereignty ended for 2,000 years, the way that Jews are persecuted and hated in so many corners of the world, and reduced in number, or at least reduced in proportion compared to the whole world. By the way, there was a time when it wasn't obvious. The Roman Empire became Christian, but it's like not totally impossible that it could have become Jewish. That would have changed the whole history of the world. But it didn't. And then here we are. But there's something amazing to me of looking at the world, looking at all the evidence and everything that has happened to Jews over their existence, and to say, yeah, you know what? We're just going to do the thing anyway. We're just going to follow the Torah. We're going to take that as part of our life. We're going to assume that this covenant has never been broken, and we're just going to keep it up, and we're going to do it for as long as possible, and God will protect us, despite the evidence to the contrary. There's something like inspiring to me about that leap of faith, of want of a better word, despite all the evidence to the contrary. I know there's something also a bit stubborn about it that I appreciate, that we won't abandon our constitution, we won't abandon our Torah, despite all the circumstances that have changed. And the ways in which we apply it in different ways, but we fundamentally won't abandon the idea that the Torah is the thing that speaks to us now, and that tells us God's will and how we should act in the world. And it's just, I think it is both a depressing but also an inspiring story of Jews in the world, that we've just clung to this covenant beyond all reasons.
Definitely a redemptive thought on which to end. Jeremy, thank you so much for coming back, and we look forward to that book and to seeing you in Edinburgh in summer, and do look forward to welcoming you back here again soon.
Thank you, Simon.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please do remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Do, of course, check out all of our exciting content we have for you on our mothership, jewishquest.org. And we do look forward to meeting again next week as we begin the exploration through Bamidbar.